two reasons. Number one, I dispute in the strongest of terms most of what you heard about me in that introduction, and the only way to settle it is to start speaking and let you be the judges for yourself about whether it's true or not true, and you'll find out soon enough of Waxman's power of exaggeration. I did, in fact, when Waxman called me, I did not hesitate for a minute in answering him that that I would come, and I had really selfish motivations. Beyond the fact that coming here is always something very special to see so many people with whom we have shared some very meaningful experiences, and so many people who I consider to be friends and have a good relationship with, and what better way to connect to Purim and to connect to all Klal Yisrael than by strengthening some of those relationships, reminding myself about them. But beyond the personal relationships that are represented here, and I mentioned something similar when I came last year, but it's even more true now, and it is honestly the reason why I was excited to come here tonight, despite whatever else is going on, that is to share with you a little bit, with or from you, a little bit what you were all lucky enough to have and to be able to experience this week going into Thursday night, Friday, and Shabbos. To be in a yeshiva, particularly in this yeshiva, over the Yom Tov of Purim. It's a very special thing. I'm fortunate to live here in Eretz Yisrael and to teach in the yeshiva. We'll make every effort to give to our Talmidim and Reishit an experience that will be of meaning and of substance that will last them the rest of their lives, and with their help and with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's help, we'll be successful at doing exactly that. But there's no comparison to a Purim in a yeshiva such as this. To be able to dance with your chavrusas and to your rabbeim, to be able to appreciate all of the depth and mystery of what Purim represents, and to celebrate with that. There are not many places in the world that will have a Purim exactly like what you will experience here, and then I'm envious of that. And to be able to be here, as Waxman said in the Shlosh Yimei Hagbalah before, that Kabbalah Satorah, before that experience, is something which is an opportunity I absolutely could not pass up. It's certainly be mentioned that we know all of the Purim season, all of the Megillah, of course, all of Purim in general is about uncovering this Hester Panim. It's a Yom Tov that does not have a lot of Gilui Shechina. It exists in a world of Hester Panim, and it's our job to uncover that which is hidden. And it's been said many times what the definition of Hester Panim is. It's not a phrase that any of us have any real difficulty in understanding or translating. It means hiding of the face. Whose face? God's face. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hidden. That's Hester Panim. Its opposite is Gilui Shechina, when the hand of God is evidence and obvious for everybody to see. It has been said, as I mentioned many times though, that Hester Panim itself has a hidden meaning and another explanation that is in almost all circumstances synonymous with the regular explanation that we know, and that is Hester Panim equals Hester Panimius. That everything has a superficial existence and a superficial definition, and at the same time it has a Panimius. Every person, every chag, everything has Hester Panimius. A existence, a world, a generation of Hester Panim is more often than not, if not always, also a generation of Hester Panimius. One can experience all the trappings of any Yom Tov, and particularly of Purim, and not tap into that Panimius, or they can uncover not just the face of God, but the Panimius that exists in everything, in every relationship, in every mitzvah, in every Daf Gemara that we learn, the Panimius that exists in that. Uncovering that Hester Panimius is as much a part of Purim and is actually synonymous with the uncovering of the Hester Panim that we're familiar with, identifying the Yad Hashem in everything that took place in Shushan and everything that takes place in Eretz Yisrael today. And as I said, I think here in this yeshiva, you are uniquely suited and given the kalim throughout your learning the entire year, given the kalim to do that digging and to uncover that Panimius. If not here, I don't know where else. And it's an absolute privilege to be here and to be part of that preparation and to be part of that feeling as we all endeavor to do that uncovering and to realize that Panimius that exists in all of the things that we do. After my Shana Aleph, I was preparing for what was my third summer in Morashat Kollel. NCSY Kollel barely existed at the time, or did not exist at the time, I'm not even exactly sure. But after having spent two summers in Morashat Kollel, I was very, very intent on sending a third in Morashat Kollel. Now, being back for a third summer anywhere, whether it's a camp or a learning program or coming back, shutting back to yeshiva, so you have a little bit, I'm not talking about in the world of guy, a big man on campus a little bit. I don't mean like I said in a guidance sense, but just you know the way things operate, you know the way things work, you know exactly what's going on, what to be. So there were certain hachanos, certain preparations that went into going to Morashat Kollel for that summer. Had to speak to certain people what the chavrusas were going to be, had to make sure that the non-learning schedule was taken care of, hook up with whoever was going to have a car, which was a very big deal, a feature that we do not have to deal with on the NCSY Kollel, but make sure you've got a seat for whatever trips might be taking place, off campus and extracurricular. And also, because it was a small base medrash and a very crowded one, makom in the base medrash was very, very important. And I gave a good deal of thought to it, probably more than I should have, but I had exactly the makom that I wanted in mind, and I made sure I wasn't going to go up with the Hamon Am on the bus, got a ride with a friend of mine, the same guy who's going to have a car, begin working on it now, got up there a couple of hours before the bus got up there, a couple of people made a beeline for the bunk to get the right bed, I made a beeline also for gashmius reasons to the base measures to get exactly the right makom, wanted the one with the window that overlooked what was then Lachon. That was great for all sorts of conversation and distraction. If ever you get a little bit bored, you just look out that window, and no doubt you would be entertained and have what to talk about for weeks on end. It was great. And I grabbed myself. That makom was the right place in the base medrash. Not too far, not too close. A good distance where you could be inspired by the Rashi Yeshiva, but not too inspired, which is the real point, and not be suffocated by them. That was the makom. Good. Then I go to the bunk. Then I take care of everything else. Meet the first. Okay. We're nice. There, everything is great. Everyone's like, nice makom, you know, okay, fantastic. Morning Seder, I show up after Shachris, the first day of the learning in Morashat Kollel. And lo and behold, I walk in and I get right up close to the makom. I have to do a double take. The tables are just like this size tables, not big at all. My makom was right over here. And over here on the table was sitting a member of the a rebbe from MTA, which is where I had attended high school also. He was on the ed staff of Morashah. He had worked out a schedule that he'd be learning Morashah Kollel during morning Seder. And he too, liked my taste, thought it was a wonderful makom to sit in. He was going to be sitting at the table right over here. Less than 12 inches from where I was going to be sitting. So I stopped short and he looked at me and he said, oh, am I sitting? Is this makom taken? And you know, you have that deliberation right then and there. I could say it is taken even though it's not, but okay, no, it's not taken. This is fantastic, and I'm already scouting out where am I moving my seat. It's not, I was holding and learning a little bit. It wasn't the worst thing in the world, but I did not want over the summer to have that pressure of every time I picked my head up out of the base medrash and every conversation I had to have a Rebbe of mine from MTA sitting right next. It's not a good idea, not interested in that whatsoever. A friend of mine gave me the following advice, which I'm sure everybody in this room could give to their own chaver. It's not the greatest insight in the history of the world, but we forget sometimes. And he said, you know, he was holding in a better place than I was. He said, you know, maybe it's a blessing in disguise. Maybe anything you would have said and done had that Rebbe not sitting right there, maybe that's not the greatest thing to be saying and doing anyway. Maybe that's a great checks and balances. Maybe you'll have your most productive learning. Maybe it'll make sense to sit there. I said, you know, you're probably right. And that's the way it was. Wasn't a robot, didn't learn every minute of every day for the entire summer. Had some conversations, made some comments, but obviously it was tempered a little bit, and tempered in a very good and productive way. I think his advice was right on the mark. It's in the bechina of what the Gemara of Brachos, of course, says about that the fear of Basar B'dam, your fear of Shemayim, should be like the fear of Basar B'dam. It's the same way. Anything that a person wouldn't do, other than if the Rebbe is sitting there, you shouldn't do it if the Rebbe's not sitting there. Fast forward, because I have a very short memory, and apparently I need to be reminded of these things from time to time. So it's now 7 or 8 years later, and I've moved over to the NCSY Kollel at this point. And as many of you have experienced on that program, so we have the incredible zechus over the summer to share the base medrash, to host in the base medrash, Rav Schechter, Rav Meir Twersky. Great, they're sitting there. It wasn't always that way. The first few years of the program, Rav Schechter came by to visit once in a while for a couple of days. Rav Schechter was in, or Twersky was in America for the entire summer. And when it first became, the opportunity presented itself that Rav Schechter and Twersky could spend, Rav Twersky and Rav Schechter could spend the summer on the Kollel. So there were some people who were very involved with the program who thought that it was a terrible idea. B'mechilas kvodav, not in any way, it wasn't a knock on them, it was a knock on us. To say, listen, maybe this is going to ruin the special character of the NCSY Summer Kollel. It's the summer, guys are going to want to talk sports, there are going to be announcements in the Beis Medrash, guys are going to want to joke around, there will be times in the Chadar Ocha where a Madrich will want to stand on a chair, make a funny face, do an impersonation, whatever it's going to be, guys need to cut loose, guys need to have a good time. I'm not talking about anything crazy, but this is the golden word that everybody threw around. This is going to inhibit everybody. This is going to ruin that delicate balance, and maybe, listen, we'll invite them for a Shabbos, you could have them come for a day, give a shiur, what could be better, maybe even stay overnight once or twice, but 3 weeks, 6 weeks, it's going to ruin that balance. And it was a decision that we were wrestling with. Is there any merit to that argument? And once again, it was a different friend, not the same guy, who said the same exact words, and it's not, perhaps it's not as obvious when it becomes lemaisa in these situations, as it may seem at first glance. He said, maybe, anything that you're doing in that Chadar Ochel, on that bus, in that base message, that you wouldn't do if Rav Schechter, yeah, there's probably one or two things that should really happen, but they won't happen because the guy's a Talmud of Rav Schechter, and not that there's anything wrong with doing what he was doing on the chair, but he just doesn't want to be perceived by his Rebbe. Good, that you may lose a thing or two like that, but Ruva de Ruva of what you will hold yourself back doing, from doing, because they are sitting in the room, are things that you probably shouldn't have been doing anyway in the first place. That was the advice he gave, that was the advice that was followed, and Baruch Hashem, their being on the Kollel has been the greatest benefit to the program in its history, and the advice was, of course, right on the mark. Why do I mention both those things to you? I'll tell you the punchline of the time we have here tonight before we develop it, because we'll just get it out right now so that we understand what we're going to try to develop and try to build to in the few minutes that we have. All of us, by all of us, I don't mean everybody in this room, I mean every thinking, feeling member of Klal Yisrael is faced this week with an absolutely colossal challenge. With a task that it boggles the mind, it is one that very few of us are even equipped to try to deal with, to try to tackle, and fewer yet will be successful. And that is to reconcile the general feeling amongst Klal Yisrael, particularly here in Eretz Yisrael, for better or worse, the feeling that we have had over the past close to 2 weeks. We stand tonight between two very significant Thursday nights. The Thursday night of 10, 11 days ago in Merkaz Harav, which shattered the equilibrium of all of us and made us think about things and reflect upon things that no one should have to think about and no one should have to reflect on. And the Thursday night of 2 nights from now, the Thursday night of 48 hours from right now, when we'll be sitting, reading the Megillah, getting ready to celebrate Purim. Are those two opposites? Are they standing and pulling us in conflicting directions, and we have to choose one path or the other? What possibly could be the response? Like I said, I mentioned those two introductory anecdotes by way of introducing the punchline, the last sentence before the beginning, before the development. So like I said, we can know what we're trying to build to over here. If when you dance on Thursday night, if when you eat and drink on Friday afternoon, you are not dancing with and sharing in the feelings and emotions of all the Talmidim of Merkaz Harav, of all of the families who just days ago got up from sitting Shiva and will be celebrating a Purim, if celebrating is the right word, without their sons for the first time in, like I said, the most unimaginable way. way possible. If our dancing, if our eating and our celebrating is not with them, if you do not sense their presence in the room, then there is probably something wrong with the dancing and the celebrating to begin with. If they are not there, if something you're doing is totally incompatible with those feelings and those emotions, if what we are experiencing and what we are doing does not have room for those personalities, for those memories, and for those people themselves, those families, if they would walk in the room and you would have to stop what you're doing right away, this is totally wrong, this is totally inappropriate, I didn't realize you were going to be here, then there's probably something wrong with what we are doing in the first place. There are three options, essentially, in how a person can deal with what's happening. He can totally, totally block out everything that happened 10 days ago, forget about it completely. And we know, especially those of us who just a year ago were in the United States, and I'm not knocking anybody's high school, I'm not knocking what's going to go on in YU or in anywhere else in America. These things have a very short shelf life when we're not living here in Eretz Yisrael, when we're not here for a long duration of time. That probably would happen. You kind of look at your watch, check the date. Is this an appropriate length of time that we can now let loose a little bit? We had a special assembly. We said some Tehillim. We did whatever we're going to do. Maybe we wrote an email. Maybe we made a donation. Whatever went on, and now we're going to put that past us, and now we're going to move on. Some people are not even on that level. They'll do the same approach. Like I said, they'll live in complete denial, either based on their inability to cope with what took place, or because of their own, it's not even that complicated, their own self-centeredness, they never related to or connected to on any level what happened. Thursday night to come is Thursday night to come, and it is totally separate, forget about, I have removed from my consciousness everything that took place two Thursday nights ago in order to experience this Thursday night to come. That's approach number one. Approach number two would be to say there is no room in my consciousness for the Thursday night to come because of my feelings about the Thursday night that passed. Because of what took place, there is no room for the simcha, there is no room for the dancing, there's no room for the eating, there's no room for the drinking, there's no room for the laughter, there's no room for the celebration. It cannot coexist with what resides in my heart as a result of what took place two Thursday nights ago. Obviously, those two approaches are not equal, but the common denominator between both of them are that they are the easy way out. They each present a very black and white, straightforward solution to the problem that a person can take to an extreme and not worry about any of the complications of reality that we're going to discuss in a minute. The third possibility, the third option, is the one that we mentioned and we will try to develop. To try to understand how everything we are going to do relates directly and is a natural and appropriate outgrowth of our reflection of what took place two Thursday nights ago. The Gemara in Brachos describes the incredible joy and sometimes overreaching joy that took place at a few particular weddings. The Gemara at the beginning of the fifth parak is, of course, the famous Gemara that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. The Gemara is describing the need for Kovei Rosh during Tefillah and is defining the concept of the Gilu Barada, of rejoicing in trembling, of some kind of balance that any Ben Torah is supposed to bring in to his periods of greatest joy. The Gemara describes one such wedding in which things were getting out of hand, where that balance was being threatened, and as a result of that threat to the balance, the Baal Simcha takes a very expensive glass and he shatters it. And again, there's a certain sense of proportion that comes back to the wedding. That's the Gilu Barada. Tosfos comments famously, a one-line Tosfos, just a few short words, that this is the source for the minhag, ad hayom hazeh, the source for the minhag of breaking a glass at the wedding. A couple of questions emerge from those few lines of Gemara and from that Tosfos. The first and less troubling one is, what about Korban? Wasn't that part of the Imesh Kachet, Yerushalayim, and saying it? Always thought that was kind of connected. Most people, they read that Tosfos for the first time and they're taken aback a little bit. What, is because people were drinking too much at the Shmorim? It's because people are having too good a time getting into the song of the day, or the Hora is kicking up a little bit too high, so we've got to tone it down a bit. That's why we break the glass. I thought everything, the ashes on the head, the breaking the glass, and that's the Chayim Yerushalayim, thought it's all connected to Korban. Maybe I was wrong, I said it's not the greatest question, but that's most people's reaction when they read the Gemara. Isn't there something Korban related that's supposed to be taking place? Question number two. What exactly was the goal and what exactly is accomplished by the breaking of the glass? What was going on that was so wrong? What was the problem? And how is that problem solved by breaking the glass? There are a number of possibilities that jump off the page. Which is the right one? Is it an alarm clock of sorts? Same thing could have been accomplished by clapping hands. Hey, remember, stop! Like that? Is it the concern that they had for the very valuable piece of glass that sobered people up right away? Is it an echo of something else? Maybe, most obviously, perhaps, the Korban or like that? The Gemara doesn't make clear, nor does Tosfos, in explaining that this is the source of the minhag, that is the most famous part of any Jewish wedding ceremony. They don't make entirely clear what's happening and why it's happening. I've heard explained on a number of occasions that the Pshat in that Gemara is so important to defining our Simcha and helps us understand exactly what's taking place and why. There are two types, and I'm sure you've heard the basis of this idea before. Let's chazer it quickly and then we'll move on. There are two types of Simcha that exist in this world. There is a Simcha, and it corresponds pretty directly to the options we laid out a few minutes ago for how to celebrate Purim this year. There is a Simcha that says, listen, my life is full of good and bad. I'm a normal person. There are things that excite me, things that thrill me, things that make me happy, and plenty of things that make me sad. If I can tone down, stop thinking enough about the things that make me sad, well then, the things that make me happy went out, and I'm a happy person, and everything is great. If I can escape, that's the key word, of course. If I can escape and deny, if I can lose from my consciousness that which upsets me, that which depresses me, then I'll be happy. That is, of course, the avenue, that is the route towards Simcha, that one takes if he has a drug habit, if he drinks alcohol on a regular basis. It does. I'll escape the world. It numbs my senses. The things that hurt me won't hurt me so much or at all. And then I stand happy. Then everything is great. There is another version of Simcha. Another way, another avenue, path, route that you could take towards Simcha that goes in the exact opposite direction. It is a worldview, an outlook, that allows me to take absolutely everything in, to cope and to deal with, not just the things in my life that I love, that excite me, that I feel good about, but allows me to have a strategy and a plan and a certain level, not necessarily of understanding, certainly not of menuchas nefesh, but a certain level of acceptance to the things that bother me, upset me, frighten me, the things that depress me. It allows me to deal with absolutely everything. When the Gemara relates to a Simcha that is not the Gilu Bira'ada, the Simcha that is, by definition, only Gila, only rejoicing, it refers to not a quantitative level of Simcha that is out of hand. It refers to a level of Simcha that is entirely one-sided. Version number one of Simcha, if you will. A Simcha that excites, makes good. How? By only focusing on the source of Simcha, on the source of good, and not reconciling it with the challenges and the frustrations that plague every single person, every single day. The breaking of the glass represents the reminder of the brokenness that exists in this world. You may or may korban, as we'll see in a few seconds, I believe you certainly should, to recognize that anything I experience, my individual simcha on the day of my wedding, cannot, for the sake of my wedding and for the sake of my simcha, be understood only in the narrow context of the marriage that I am taking part in right now, but must be something that gives me the tools and the ability to deal with the entire world. To take in everything that has happened to me, everything that exists, everything in the world, and to be able to move forward with it. The good, the bad, and the ugly. I'll bring you a sociological proof. It's not a riot from the Gemara, from the Rambam. Just an experience that virtually everybody in the room has had. And you'll see exactly what we're talking about in this idea. And if that is in fact the pshat in the Gemara or not, I think it's the only time I ever bring such a sociological proof to a pshat in the Gemara. By a show of hands, at how many people's bar mitzvah did your mother or father or some other relative, usually your mother or father, your mom or dad get up and make reference or comment about those people who are no longer with us? It's a great simcha today. I'll ask the show of hands in a sec. Great simcha today, but it's too bad. Grandpa, grandma, and this, too bad they can't be here today. And how many people's bar mitzvah did that take place? Some version of that speech. Okay, virtually, it's usually not everybody, but it's a fairly common staple of the bar mitzvah circuit. Why do people make that speech? I'll give you three choices. Possibility number one, any time in a room like this, representative of so many different communities, so many different places, and you have such a large percentage of people doing anything, that it kind of snowballs and everybody does it because everybody else does it. It's possible. Possible you're sitting there the night before the bar mitzvah, and your mom and dad are saying, hey, someone's going to give that speech because what's a bar mitzvah without it? Can't have a bar mitzvah without sushi. Can't have a bar mitzvah without a little carnation on your lapel. You can't have a bar mitzvah without that speech. That's why people give it. I don't think that's the pshat. Here's possibility number two. Possibility number two is that your mom and dad are looking over at the bar mitzvah. It seems to be going great. But then they look over to table 36. Uncle Louie has had a few too many drinks. So your mom nudges your dad, says that, you know what? Uncle Louie's getting a little bit out of control. This would be a good time to remind him that Aunt Edna is dead. This would be a good time. Let's sober him up a little bit. Let's knock things down. You know, if things are getting a little bit too quantitatively happy, let's bring it down a notch or two. Let's remind everybody, hey, you know what? It's a good time to remind everybody things aren't so great. The party's going to end. They're getting too excited. Absurd. That's not what happened in anybody's bar mitzvah. You know what happened in your bar mitzvah? You can correct me if I'm wrong. There was a sense of simcha that no one here who is not a parent can fully imagine, but you can begin to try to relate to it. The simcha of a parent bringing a child into the state of the bar mitzvah. Is it possible for that parent not to think about everything that brought the child to that day? Is it possible for the parent to be focused so narrowly and so carefully on the simcha of the bar mitzvah and of nothing else? Is it possible if the parent wanted to not think about the tragedies of the family, those who have lost, would they be able to do it if they tried? That's what a person thinks about when the glass is broken at the wedding. The wedding, the simcha, is not about today only. It's not about this event in a vacuum and nothing else. It's about everything. If the wedding is not about korban, if the wedding is not a step towards rebuilding that which has been lost, then it is less a wedding. If the wedding is not, if the simcha is only about the joy I feel for this right now, and doesn't relate directly as an appropriate, meaningful, substantive response to the tragedies that were experienced, to the sense of korban and loss that everybody feels, it is less a simcha. It is not succeeding to the extent to which the simcha should. It's not taking advantage of everything that the simcha represents. Easier said than done. So what does that mean practically? What does a person have to celebrate? What does a person have to relate to and focus on that is going to allow them to feel anything but sorrow and anguish come this Thursday night? It's a beautiful idea, and maybe you're convinced convinced of it, that that's the highest level of simcha. But Lemaisa, we've got, like I said, this enormous, you know, if I were to get up here and speak about the evils of kaf, try not to be, it's a challenge for some people. Get up here and speak about, don't waste time, no more bittul Torah. Okay, it's a challenge for some people, harder for some than it is for others. I can't think of something which is more a more difficult challenge, like we said at the outset. So that's the goal. We're supposed to try to experience a simcha that encompasses everything that I've experienced, the good and the bad, and puts it in a certain direction, and gives us something on which to build, some direction in which we can grow. How does a person do a lemaisa? In Merkaz Harav this past Thursday night, at the Shiurim and Hespedim to mark the end of the Shiva, so Rav Avraham Shapiro's grandson-in-law, he suggested an idea in the name of his grandfather that I think will give us another piece of the puzzle. And I can assure you, in the time that we have, there's no way, if we had all the time in the world, we wouldn't put all the pieces of the puzzle into place. There's no way possible to do it, and I certainly wouldn't be the one to try, and never would be the one to succeed. But we'll get another piece of the puzzle by analyzing, by studying, by thinking about his incredible words. We all know that among the most basic mitzvos in the Torah, the mitzvah of Ahavat Hashem, the paragraph that marks the beginning of Kriyat Shema, the Ahavat Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha u'b'chol nafshecha u'b'chol miyodecha. So the Gemara in Brachos, also a very well-known Gemara, is even more specific and clear about what those obligations entail. To love God and to serve God with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our me'odecha, whatever that means. And the Gemara famously says, everybody knows it, b'chol levavcha means with your two hearts, with your yetzer tov and your yetzer hara. An all-encompassing way of serving God with all of your inclinations and all of your urges, that's what b'chol levavcha means. B'chol nafshecha means to serve God with even giving over your life. Your life itself needs to be given over in the service of God. You can imagine saying those words in Merkaz Harav last Thursday night at the end of the Shiva. And u'b'chol me'odecha, so the Gemara has two opinions over there, famously with all your money, perhaps something a little bit deeper with all of your midos, with all of your ma'od, very many beautiful ideas shared on that third line of the Gemara. So Rabbi Shapiro asked a very simple question. The three are not, they're not the same. They're something incongruous about the list. Number one and three talk about how a Jew should lead his life. You lead your life serving God with everything you have. Everything that you have spiritually, every inclination, like we said, the whole levavcha, every aspect of your heart and your emotion, everything in the service of God. And the whole modacha means you serve God, you live a life of service to God that includes all your money, all your possessions, all your midos, all of that. The whole nafshecha, on the surface, is telling you something else entirely. Not how to live your life, but how to die al pi kiddush Hashem. That you must, in certain circumstances, forfeit all that you've been blessed with God, all that you've been given, and all of that potential, that you must give that up, give even your life in the service of God. Even if somehow you want to say, it's, you know, okay, it's really all about serving God, and who said it's only in life? But the order is striking, it's bizarre. Life, death, life, what does it mean? Rav Avraham Shapiro explains it means a fundamental error that we are making if we believe for a minute that that is even a question. When the Gemara tells us, b'chol nafshecha, even to the extent to which you give your life, it does not mean to tell us how to die. It is telling us exactly how we are to live. A person, even if, with the help of God, never called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice, who is cognizant, who is clear on the fact that the commitment to Avodas Hashem, that the commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu requires potentially even that ultimate sacrifice, it is inconceivable that his life, his living days, the decisions that he makes walking around in peace and security and happiness are not fundamentally different than they would be otherwise. changes everything about them. I remember, and a few of you were with me then, two summers ago, in the middle of the second Lebanon War, as they call it now. So on Tisha B'Av that summer, I attended what was amongst the most dramatic funerals that I ever attended. I hope never to attend another like it. But it was a funeral of Michael Levine, who was a Jew from Philadelphia, American, volunteered in the Israeli army, and a casualty of the Lebanon War. His Leviathan took place on Tisha B'Av. We could talk all night about things I learned that day and heard that day regarding his Leviathan. But leading up to the Leviathan, I was walking with Rav Meir Twersky, and we were approaching the place where they were going to lay him to rest, where the Kvura was going to be. And to get there, we had to walk through a decent amount of Har Herzl. Now, Har Herzl, I'm sure most, if not all of you, have been there. Those who haven't will get a chance later on in the year, I imagine. Har Herzl is an indescribably powerful place. You have matzeva after matzeva that are not outlandish or flamboyant. They're simple matzevos that are all virtually identical. A name, a place, the war, place of birth, the war in which the soldier fell, and the ages. And the ages are really where it hits home, because you go row after row, matzeva after matzeva, and you see the sacrifice that the wars that we have fought in this country, the sacrifice, the toll it has taken on this generation and the previous generation, you see what's been lost. And what are you going to do in that situation? There were no Shilas. I was asking her, Twersky, and asking him, what do you think, Rebbe? And they're not going to say anything. We were walking in silence, a silence that was more pregnant with meaning and with substance than any words could ever fill. We were walking in silence, and he said, under his breath, but very, very clearly, he said, not to me even, he was in a trance almost, he said, this is the strength of Eretz Yisrael. This is it. This is the koach. This is the strength of who we are. This is the strength of this land. I can tell you beyond any shadow of a doubt that intuitively I knew that he was right. You felt it. You might not be able to explain it, but you felt it in that place on that day. Tisha B'Av in our Herzl, laying Michael Levine to rest, hearing those espadim and walking along those matzevos, you felt the strength. You could not deny it if you tried. But I don't know, I don't believe, I don't know if I, the feeling was so strong, I probably didn't even notice that I didn't fully understand it. Not until I heard the word that Hespit last Thursday night did I understand fully, intellectually even, exactly what that means. The strength of Eretz Yisrael, day to day, walking in a makolet, farming your land, observing the mitzvot tuluyot baretz for sure, sitting in a base medrash, looking out at these hills all around us, understanding the strength of that comes from what is lying in our Herzl. The strength of that comes from the Kedoshim who gave their life ultimately, b'chol nafshecha, the ultimate realization of the sacrifice that this land entails. What the other famous in Gemara Brachos, of course, says that has been quoted time and time again, because what else do we have to say after all? Of the Yisurim in which Eretz Yisrael is nicknamed, of the sacrifice, the pain, the tears that have to go on before we are zocha and privileged to Eretz Yisrael. But when that price is paid, the connection and the realization of the importance and the centrality of Eretz Yisrael is all the greater. That is its strength. After that price, after you walk through our Herzl and you walk down the block, you walk down Sderot Herzl on your way to Tachanah Merkazit to get yourself a shawarma and hop on the bus or the Sherut, whatever you take to go back to Shalvin, the day-to-day activities, the day-to-day life, even if we're not being called upon for that sacrifice, they are fundamentally different. There is a strength, there is a vitality that is included in that. Of course, what took place in Merkaz Arab was the juncture, not just between, it wasn't just about Eretz Yisrael, it was Talmud Torah in Eretz Yisrael. Young boys in yeshiva, sitting and learning, we can't even describe what took place because it hits too close to home. They are us and we are them. Engaging in the Talmud Torah that we engage to that Torah. It is the blood upon which we build and we understand the Kol Nafshecha. Not that if we will too be prepared to make. We don't talk in those terms. But that even when we are not called upon that to make that sacrifice, our commitment and our understanding of the centrality of that Torah and of this land is all the stronger. I hate to switch gears so abruptly, but I'm going to throw out you'll see in a minute, its pertinence, a rather whimsical trivia question. What was the cover of Sports Illustrated immediately after 9/11? Some of you may have heard this question from me before, but if you did, don't give away the answer. What was the cover of Sports Illustrated the week after 9/11? Anybody know? Go ahead.
Share the American flag on it.
So there is I don't know what the word is, and not black and white and not color, I don't know what's it called? Yeah, Sapphire, or whatever it's called. Okay, that's what it's called. This darkened stadium and a very dramatic looking empty plastic nondescript chair in some arena or stadium, we'll never know which, and it has an American flag draped on it, and the words on the bottom are something to the effect of
Sports stood still.
Something like that. I was going to say today, but the week works also. The week Sports stood still. That is, of course, those who are really bekeyed in their Sports Illustrated and see everything through this. That's all right. It's, everybody knows that that's the answer. Except that it's not the answer. That's the wrong answer. Learn well. That's great. You would never make a mistake if I answer a Gemara question. Who has bekeyed in Sports Illustrated? That's not the right answer. The answer that everybody gives, it's not the right answer. 9/11/2001, September 11th, was a bright, sunny Tuesday morning in New York. Sports Illustrated goes to print on Tuesday. That's when the issues come out, they roll off the press. And on Tuesday afternoon, it was far too late to stop any truck, to stop the presses, to get that issue ready. On Tuesday afternoon, September 11th, the Sports Illustrated that were thrown to every newsstand around the country, that arrived in every subscriber's mailbox on Wednesday, on Thursday, on Friday, depending on how quick your mail works, was a red cover, very bright red cover, with a picture of David Carr, who was going to become the number one draft pick and then have a not such great career. At the time, he played for the Fresno State Bulldogs, whose colors were red and white, hence the Red Sports Illustrated. And it was something to the effect of red hot Bulldog or something like that. David Carr leading Fresno State to absolutely nowhere because that's where they're going. Yeah. Now, that was the cover of Sports Illustrated for the week after 9/11. On 9/18/2001, 7 days after the terrible attack, that's when the cover of the week Sports stood still. That's when it hit the newsstands. That's when it went into people's mailboxes. Even if you love sports more than any rational person should, that has got to be the least read issue in the history of the magazine. There is nobody above the emotional age of 8 who could possibly have cared about David Carr on September 11th, or 12th, 13th, or 14th. Not in the bathroom, not as a diversion. If you tried to read it, it would be like, in one ear and out the other, and I can't even focus on this. The most insignificant thing imaginable. There is nothing less relevant in the world right now. Nothing, even if I'm not talking about a guy who loves the opera. This guy loves sports. But you couldn't have cared less about David Carr and the Fresno State Bulldogs. So I had a very good friend who happened to have loved sports and be in that category of beyond any rational, okay, love sports. And he also was in my chevra, the last of my chevra to get married. I was, many of us, were married, had a few kids, had moved on in life. He was living in an apartment in the Upper West Side. I could figure out exactly how old he was, but he was getting on in years a little bit. He was very depressed that he was the only one in the chevra not to be married. And that summer, great simcha for everybody, he had gotten engaged. Unfortunately for him, it wasn't his wedding, no problem with that. It would have had all sorts of questions about what to do then. But his engagement party, which was marked on all of our calendars as an incredible celebration for the entire chevra, for the entire chabura, his engagement party was scheduled for Thursday night, September 13th. On Tuesday night, September 11th. On that Tuesday night, in my email mailbox, and many of my friends' mailbox, there was a short email from him. And it said, needless to say, Thursday night's engagement party is canceled. ... I feel a lot like David Carr. That's what he wrote in his email. Celebration, a band, engagement party. That is so irrelevant, so unimportant. It's almost embarrassing to mention it. Needless to say, engagement party canceled. ... I feel like David Carr. A lot on that September 11th saddened me. But that email was like another blow. And it disturbed me. I was upset by it. I felt like something was wrong. So I thought about it. And it was a friend who I joked with much more than I ever was serious with. But I wrote him a very serious email in response after I got my thoughts together. And what I wrote to him was, understand very clearly. You are right in your decision. An engagement party is not a halakhically significant event. It's to move it in fairness and appropriateness to what took place to a different time and in a different week. No question it's the right decision. But the analogy between you and David Carr is nothing short of obscene. It's the most wrong and incorrect thing you've ever said. It is true that a Sports Illustrated cover about the Fresno State Bulldogs in the face of the enormity of the tragedy of 9/11 is utterly and completely meaningless. It cannot have any status, any importance, any significance for anybody. Sports has its place in the world. We can talk about that at a different time. But its place is not at the forefront of our mind when these events, world tragedies, are unfolding. Masha ain't came your wedding and your engagement party. You are part of the rebuilding process. We did not perish in 9/11. We are alive to rebuild. We are alive to build houses like the one you are going to build with your challah. We are alive to celebrate that rebuilding process and to pursue it to every extent that it can be pursued with as much passion and feeling as we can possibly muster, with as much energy and love as we could possibly find. And yeah, we'll celebrate at different times, but rest assured, whenever that engagement party takes place, and at the chasna, please God, we will celebrate together with full, with heavy hearts. That's not a contradiction. With heavy hearts, but with full feeling that this is the step forward. That this is where we go from here. That this is how and when we start to rebuild. Rav Huttner quotes in his Mamorim on Sukkot. He quotes an idea that is pertinent and relevant to Simchas Torah. I quote it virtually every single Sukkot in preparation for Simchas Torah, especially in Rashid, as you'll hear in a minute. And I could not help but think about it in my own effort to come to grips with what is going to take place at the end of this week. It's not a vart, it's not a Torah idea, it's a simple, simple maisa that took place in the Beis Medrash of the Chidushei Arim. The Beis Medrash of the Chidushei Arim on Simchas Torah, you can imagine, as I began with tonight and talking about Purim and Shalvim, the Beis Medrash of the Chidushei Arim on Simchas Torah, well, it was not just flags and apples and tying talis into chairs. It was a genuine and real celebration of the completion of Torah, of an appreciation for Torah. And when the Hasidim dance, and they dance with the Chidushei Arim in their Beis Medrash, around the Aron Kodesh, around the Bima, with the Torah in their hands, it's hard for us to even imagine what that meant and what that was about. And there were two Hasidim in the Chidushei Arim's Beis Medrash who felt this as much as anybody. And as the dancing began, one of them closed his eyes, and he began to shake, and he began to tremble. And he began to dance like nobody's ever danced before, feeling this simcha, feeling this connection to Torah. And somebody said to the Chidushei Arim, that guy, I've never seen anything like it, he's going to go on forever. And the Chidushei Arim says, take a look at that guy, he's going to go even further, he's going to dance even more. Didn't look likely. And to, he's still going strong. He's still dancing. He's still emoting. He's still feeling. And they asked the Kiddush Yarim to explain. And he said, you know what Simchas Torah is all about? Celebration of the Torah. Our commitment to it. This chassid, nobody learned more than he did this year. Nobody had more to celebrate at the Siyum of Simchas Torah, the first chassid. That's why you saw it on his face. The type of emotion and feeling that can't be fake. There's nothing like it in the world. The second chassid, he was dancing with the emotion and the feeling of the Torah of next year. The Torah that he was mekabel upon himself to learn. The Torah that he wanted to learn. The Torah that he wanted to be part of and be connected to. Said the Chiddush Yarim, the Torah that a person learns what happened in the past is could be an enormous amount. It could blow us all away and we can't even imagine it. But at the end of the day, it's by definition finite. But the Torah that is going to be, that guy can dance all night. There's no limit to the Torah that we're going to learn, says the Chiddush Yarim. And it's a beautiful idea, I'll remind you. It's a great idea, like I said, he's saying in ratio respect. What the guy has to celebrate necessarily, he gets off the plane. But you tell him what the year is going to be, okay, it's a beautiful idea. I quote it all the time. But I thought about it, not in the most pleasant and happy of moods throughout the week, as the Mahalik is the way out. A celebration of what's happened, impossible. A joy based on thinking about what's taking place, inconceivable. But if a person understands that every simcha in our lives, and particularly the holy, holy simcha of Purim, the kedusha which it entails, is a simcha that allows us to take everything in, to be mechazik our emunah, to strengthen our understanding and appreciation of the Yad Hashem and everything that happens, that's a simcha that we are allowed to and obligated to pursue vigorously. And secondly, to understand that we, who were brothers in arms with the Talmidim of Merkaz Arav, who were sitting and learning Torah Hashem in Eretz Yisrael, we have the way to build up and build stronger. The sacrifice that they made for us, not just in being the Karbanos, not just being in the ones who were called about to give their lives, but in the demonstration, as Rav Ram Shapiro explained, in the demonstration of that B'chol Natsicha, and what it means for our living Torah, and for our lives as B'nai Torah, and what it means for our future, there is what for us to celebrate. There is what for us to rejoice in that promise and that future, in that potential that we are lucky enough to have. I do not know if any of this quote-unquote works. I don't even know what that means. It's certainly not an answer. It's certainly not something which will make sense of everything that happened. It's certainly not something that will solve every problem or every question. What it is a tiny step. A tiny step towards an appreciation for what took place, for what was lost, for what we need to reflect on in terms of that Mesiras Nefesh. And for how all of that relates to our simcha, to our going forward, and to our Purim,